Episode 29. Let's go.
Medic one inbound to your facility. Emergency traffic with a 45-year-old male in cardiac arrest. Following multiple gunshot wounds. CPR in progress. Patient invasion IO in place. Stay with you in 5 minutes.
Welcome to the EMS Handoff, your source for all things EMS. And now, let's welcome to the show your hosts, Bradley Dean, Eric McCullough, and David Blevins.
Hello, and welcome to the EMS Handoff Podcast. This is David, and along with my co-hosts, Bradley Dean and Eric McCullough, we are your source for all things EMS. Tonight, I'm going to stop here. I'm not even going to say the distinguished word. He's been here before, and there's no distinguished about him. But he does have one of our EMS Handoff shirts on. He was one of the first ones to buy them. He's flaunting it tonight. So he's distinguished because of that. But before we get there, we're going to jump over to Bradley Dean, see how things in North Carolina land are going.
It was great. So last weekend and this weekend, I was actually in the trenches. We were doing trench rescue based off of some of the stuff that we talked about with Doug and everything else that spurred lots of discussion here over the past week after that podcast posted. So it's been great. Weather held out for us to be able to do it.
I was wondering if you heard anything from that, because I feel like you above all would get a lot of feedback about that podcast episode.
Yeah, so it spurred quite a bit of discussion locally and a couple other places here about getting more paramedics trained in doing rescue.
That's awesome.
Well, you know, that's what we're here for, is to start the discussion. So, good to hear that. Now we're going to go to the other side, the one that decided to jump the gun before his name gets said. And that's because he's been posting on our social media, going all but viral, asking about the quotes or the best advice and recently the best books to put on the EMS reading list. So,
yeah. Eric. So here's the thing. Like, I do want us, like we were talking about, you're just talking about a conversation starter. Well, please come to our Facebook page. If you're listening to this podcast, YouTube, we got our YouTube out. I do want to make sure that people know that our YouTube page is out. Hopefully we'll have some stuff coming out there. I'd like to be able to at least discuss some of the stuff that's going on Facebook, because a lot of people are making really good suggestions, not only from the advice and from the leadership stuff. I'll have more stuff that I think that would be wise for people to have. And I think our group is niche enough to where they're niche enough and professional enough, and maybe not professional. I don't know, but they're at least engaging. So it's been pretty exciting this week just to be able to talk and hang around with some of that.
Well, I tossed on a couple of books there, and I think it's a great conversation because we've got a good Facebook group out there, and to see that and that engagement, they were all really good comments, and really thought that was kind of interesting. So, good putting that out there. But before we introduce our guest this evening, we'd like to thank our podcast partner, the Journal of Emergency Medical Services. They've been a tremendous partner to the EMS Handoff podcast. That's been easy for me to say this week. While the EMS Handoff serves for your source for all things EMS and the podcast first, Jim's has been an industry leader in our profession for many years. So make sure to go by their website, support their efforts to keep the industry informed, and also check out our fellow Jim's podcasters that are out there as well, keeping the EMS Today podcast plugging every week. So make sure to go by Google, Spotify, or Apple and follow the EMS Today podcast. And with that, I'm going to toss in a plug, like Eric said as well. Our YouTube is up and running, and we're getting a ton on these video feeds every week. So make sure, we're also going to be tossing in a couple of shorts every once in a while here and there, following up on some of our episodes, as you see here. So don't forget to find this fine apparel that our distinguishedly dressed guest of the evening has went and found with our Pursue partner in apparel. The Pursue Company is providing some short sleeve, long sleeve, and hoodies. As you see us all, except for Eric, I don't know what's going on with him. Make sure to check out the Pursuit Companies at pursuitoutfitters.com/EMS handoff. Pick the color of your choice and get started. So, Bradley Dean, before we waste any more time, we're going to get into this great topic. Let's introduce our guest for this week.
This week, we've got Jason Hagg. He's back with us. He's a well-traveled EMS educator, a powerful speaker, does a great job at conferences. He's currently the a quality assurance analyst, and he's more than has more than 18 years of fire and EMS experience. He started in 2003 and advanced to the paramedic level in 2006. In 2008, he studied at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County to obtain a certification in critical care transport. And he's got lots of experience transporting critically ill patients, doing a lot of stuff with QA. He was an EMS supervisor from 2010 to 2018 and teaches all over New York on his days off. He does stuff with the Rotary, Ducks Unlimited. Jason, thanks for coming back and being a repeat offender.
Okay, Jason, hold on. So how much have you got to pay Bradley to say all that stuff?
I wrote it. He read it.
Powerful conference presence that's doing all of this good stuff. We've already talked to you once, but really?
But I cut it down. He's got a full page of stuff that he does.
He went and talked to Wes and they typed it all out. It's all legal. It's all good. All right. Is there anything else, Jason, you'd like to say about yourself before getting started today?
Then since our last episode, my house has grown by 8 legs. So
it all depends on exactly how that happened as to just how much of a concern we put into that, because it could just be 2 4-legged things or 4 2-legged things. That's a completely different aspect altogether.
I've got a 12-week-old yellow lab and a 9-week-old chocolate. So,
While the kids are great, adding 4 2-legged things would have been a lot more concerning there. So, right. The 2 4-legged ones are great. So welcome back, Jason. Yes. Go to hit your kind of wheelhouse as we talk about documentation. Last time we talked briefly about those patient refusals, no patient contacts. And we're going to expand on that just a little bit as well into those areas as well. So let's go ahead and just jump in. I give you the opening salvo on that. So what is it about patient refusals, no patient contacts, those kind of things that we need to know?
So there's a couple things that happen with those, right? We'll look at it from the medical legal side first, clinical and medical legal, and we'll talk about a little bit about documentation as far as reimbursement goes with these encounters. The first thing that I always bring people's attention to with this topic is that these are going to be your longer charts for the most part, unless they're a critical ALS chart with multiple interventions. These charts are typically, especially if it's a patient refusal, against medical advice, those are typically going to be your longest charts. And most likely some of the charts that are going to come back later, either in a positive or a negative manner, depending upon how things go. Patient refusals always kind of scare me a little bit. That changed a little bit with COVID. The landscape of that changed, and we'll talk about that a little bit more in a few moments. But I don't like doing refusals, especially when there's something blatantly wrong with a patient. You have to document your conversations, which is important. You also have to really document the patient's decisional making capacity. And what is that? What's decisional making capacity in North Carolina? What is it in Tennessee? What is it in Texas? What is it in New York? All right. I always make the statement that, if you're looking for somebody to be able to refuse care, they have to be competent. But what's the definition of competent? if you get three lawyers in a room and ask them what the definition of competence is, you will probably have six different answers. What I teach is if the patient is alert and oriented to person, to themselves, to the place where they're at, to what time it is, and the condition, and I figured that one out by asking, why am I here? What's going on? If they're alert and oriented to those four things, I personally am comfortable allowing them to refuse transport. I may not like it, but I allow it to happen. You know, we have to remember that if these patients are of legal age to consent and they have been given informed consent information, that they have absolutely have the right to refuse transport, the right to refuse care. I think we should probably go down this rabbit hole for a minute before we jump into no patient contact, because that's an entirely different rabbit hole.
All right, so let's go down that route. So as you mentioned, there's a ton to unbox here when we talk about the patient refusal, right? So let's talk about basically when that patient refusal is at the very beginning, all right? Because I have a couple of questions that I jotted down here, and I really think they kind of play based on who, what, when, where, and why ultimately. So let's talk about the very beginning. And so, you know, Jason is dispatched to we'll just say a diabetic patient, and they arrive, and ultimately the diabetic patient has been able to get a little bit of food and something to drink. Family caught it and started bringing that sugar up. So by the time you get there and things are all fine. So that patient refuses, like, I don't want to go to the hospital. I don't know why they called you. So let's talk about that. Let's get into what we should take a look at. What is our responsibility, you know, after we leave that call as well? So let's kind of unbox into that realm right there.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I don't even know why they called. Why are you here? Hey, somebody was concerned. They gave us a call. We showed up. Is it okay if we check you out? I know you say you're okay. Is it okay if we check you out just to make sure? I understand you don't want to go to the hospital, but I'm here. I'd like to make sure you're okay. Is it all right if we do that? You know, and that's kind of how I personally would lead into that. And I document it the same way, you know, like I think I talked about it in the last episode. The first entry of my activity log will always read something similar to the effect of, you know, arrived at patient's side, introductions made, learned chief complaint in HPI. If I get report from anybody, that's documented there. And then the next line is implied or informed consent is obtained. And that's what I'd kind of put in that activity log, depending on the charting system that you're using, of that initial encounter. You know, if I don't get consent, cool. This is a patient story. They don't want anything to do with me. I'm out of here. That's that no patient contact kind of thing. But, you know, if we're going to go down the direction of where they allow us to do a little bit of an evaluation, that's where I'd start, you know, make sure that we get their consent to do it. And then go forward with that. You know, hey, I'm here. Somebody called us. I'd like to do my job. Let me do it for a minute. And we'll check you out and see how you're doing. Make sure you actually are okay.
Well, let's get into the definition then of consent specifically. And that's where a lot of people start to get into the question, as you kind of referenced it earlier, you know, what can you do and when? You know, so we talk about the ones basically, my grandmother used to love this. She taught CPR all the time. And when it comes to expressed consent, you know, expressed is one of those that we kind of, it is known that we're going to make those decisions for them based on their best knowledge. They're not able to make it. So my grandmother always said is, you know, as long as they're conscious, they're able to tell you, once they pass out, it's assumed they changed their mind. And so we're going to go. And that's expressed consent, right?
Yep.
And then the other side we're taking a look at is that informed consent. And that's where we kind of have to be rather detailed in what we're doing. So that's when that person tells you, you know, you're responding to Eric and Eric says, yes, you can. And that informed portion is you've gone through your process and said, hey, this is what I need to do. I need to check some vital signs. I need to ask you some questions. Do you care if I do that?
Right.
Yep. So before we ever do anything, we get into, hey, Because if we don't get one of those, if we don't have those, then we can actually get in trouble for ever getting into patient refusals.
Sure. Absolutely. You know, thankfully, it doesn't happen to us often. But, you know, before I took this job in documentation and billing that I have now and read a bunch of other people's charts, I mean, I was doing QA for my agency, but I mean, hundreds of different agencies now. You know, I saw somebody, and I think I mentioned this last time, you know, I saw in their chart that they documented that they got consent on the first entry of their interventions. And ever since then, I've done the same thing. I probably spent 15 years taking care of patients and never once documenting that I ever had consent to touch them. And by the grace of God, I didn't get hung up. I didn't get put in a bad place. You know, so documenting that these patients are actually allowing us to touch them and to treat them and assess them is huge. And if you ever end up going into a bad spot with one of these refusals, well, you know, you're on the stand, Mr. Haig, this patient, you didn't transport this patient to the hospital. Did you have their permission to not take him to the hospital? Well, absolutely. As a matter of fact, when I first got there, I had their consent to assess them. And then you can continue about your documentation and see that the patient understood the risks of refusal and adamantly refused, you know, however many times you document it. But that consent initially is so important. And it leads us down the rest of this.
So you start baking that into like your documentation process as you're writing, you'll be like, so you get like consent for procedures and for destinations and things like that. You'll doc, because that's a really good idea to put as part. Because I know it's part of like in hospital clinical documentation. You have to document, have signatures on consents. But I guess we don't think about that, because the only time we think about consent, and this is going kind of off the refusal reservation right now, because the only time we think about consent is during refusals. We don't think about it when we're getting ready to do an IV on somebody or give them a medication or something like that.
Yep. Patient allows writer to perform, you know, venipuncture, 18 gauge in the left AC, blah, 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 blah. I don't necessarily do patient consent to transportation. I document where that patient wants to go. Patient requests transport to ABC Hospital for evaluation and treatment. If there's any discussion, obviously that'll get documented in there. You know, in the realm of refusals, documenting the HPI, and I usually close the HPI with where the patient wants to get transported to. In these cases, if I know that it's a refusal up front, patient requests evaluation by EMS only. Initially refuses transport to the hospital. And then obviously as the call continues, I'd get a little bit more into the meat and potatoes of that. But right up front, if it's this particular case, the diabetic that's like, I'm fine, I don't even need you, why are you here? You know, right up front, that'd be right in the HPI immediately.
What would you say to, okay, so here's a scenario. So get on scene, bad diabetic patient, hypoglycemic, altered, all that stuff. They get an IV in place. They give dextrose. He wakes up. He wants to refuse care. So there's a lot of, you know, not only services, people I've talked to, experiences I've had, and things like that, where it's just like, sorry, buddy, you've got an IV in. You got to go with us. What have you come across a situation similar to?
I've come across situations similar to that. Luckily, I work in a system where we're allowed to, if there's an IV in and their sugar's up and they're going to have somebody hanging out with them, or they've eaten some complex carbs, I DC that IV, see you later. You know, and if the patient doesn't want to go to the hospital, we do not take them to the hospital. And that's become a little bit more time consuming. We eliminated D50, much like a lot of other systems have, and we went to D10. Obviously a little bit more clinically less shocking to the body. But some of the diabetic wake-ups that we've always called them don't necessarily happen on scene, because if we start this D10 infusion and they haven't woke up in 5 or 10 minutes, my internal transport clock starts going off. And maybe by the time their sugar's up high enough, we're already on the way to the hospital.
Yeah.
And obviously I can't drop them off on the side of, you know, bumpy New York State Road and let them out. That's not a thing.
You can't drop them off at Krispy Kreme.
If we had one, I'd drop them off there.
Yeah, see, what would you say if someone were to ask you, what's the dark side of informed consent? Because expressed consent is one thing. Informed consent is quite the other. Like our favorite's implied consent. We like that one. That's our favorite. Yeah. Yeah, that's the go-to. But what's the dark side of informed consent?
Informed consent's dark side is it could be changed basically whenever they want it to be changed. You know, okay, you know, I don't want you to touch me anymore. I'm done. You're out of here. You're done. Time's up. And, you know, we'll sometimes get that with our with some of our mental health patients and maybe some of our developmentally delayed patients that still have competence. But, you know, you get a patient, for example, somebody that's on the autism spectrum, maybe somebody with Asperger's, you know, everything's good. And for some reason, something switches and all of a sudden, no, go away. You're not touching me anymore. That's the dark side of informed consent, is it can change.
And so you actually with that going directly where some of my next are is. We're responsible to listen to that no matter where it occurs. As you mentioned, going with the D5, D10, you know, drips, now like so many places are going to, you may literally be in the middle of your transport. You know, you're waiting there and going to see. And, you know, we'll come back to talk about, you know, the issues about transporting or not transporting after you've treated a patient. But at any point in time, they have that ability. And the minute they revoke that consent, whether it's for a specific skill or even the transport, you have to listen to that. Because if not, that places us in a position that, you know, additional legal matters exist. But as you were saying, the end of week in New York or even here in Tennessee, if we're on the back roads and the patient absolutely states that they want out of the ambulance now, and you can't talk them in and they have the rational understanding going back to that informed consent. They know that they're getting off on a roadway. If we continue to take them, then we can get in trouble for kidnapping or other
sure
aspects. So this refusal doesn't only exist in the realm of transport, as we've kind of talked about. As you mentioned, it's about specific skills. So a patient has rights to accept or reject any treatment that you may offer. Right. And it may not be all treatments. It can be just, I don't want that or I don't want this, right?
Right.
And
it's not good enough just to document that either. You know, depending on your system, at least where I practice, we have that refusal form that not only says transport on it, but you know, IV, spinal motion restriction, you know, medication administration, all sorts of treatments. This documenting that the patient refuses is not good enough because that's your word against theirs. That signature is gold. That signature is huge. That's physical proof of their refusal of that particular treatment.
So I'm going to toss a complex situation out there. And let's have a little bit of fun with this. You know, why not? It's the handoff. That's what we do.
Sure.
So we have, because as we know, there are certain population subgroups in our country that they don't want IV fluids. They don't want blood products. They don't want certain things. So what if I have an underage individual that absolutely refuses a treatment? And when I say underage, we'll say 15, you know, and not emancipated, not, you know, they're still living with mom and dad, those kind of things. And they say, hey, that treatment is against my religion. That treatment's against my beliefs, that treatment. But you're saying, hey, it's a critical thing that you absolutely need. Where does that get us?
Can I answer before Jason so I can see what his response would be just for fun? Because I don't know if we'll be the same or not. So, Jason, I would for David's scenario, I would actually go with the treatment I'm supposed to provide based off of my own protocols and deal with the fallout. I have not been in that position. So I'm telling you, and I'm nervous about saying this because I'm recorded. I can get blasted by everybody on Facebook and thankfully on Instagram and hopefully more on YouTube. I'll get blasted on there too. But I'll continue to follow those guidelines and hopefully try to reach somebody that can, you know, give me some better direction, like a parent or something like that. But if I'm put in that situation and I'm the medic and I'm going to document this, you're going to be reading my documentation. It's going to say I gave this treatment even though it was against their religious things because he didn't want IV fluids and I gave him IV fluids. So what do you think, Jason? Are you going to go after me? Are you with me on that? Or
I'm with you. They're not at the legal age of consent. I cannot contact anybody who is of legal age of consent and legally responsible for this patient. I'm going with you. That is implied consent in my professional opinion at that moment. If, you know, the patient's a minor who's not able to sign or consent for themselves, I am taking implied consent in that particular case as a person of rational thought in the same scenario would consent to that, right? The same kind of consent that we think of that we consider having if somebody's unresponsive. That's essentially what we have here as far as consent goes, because there's nobody who's able to respond to us. We can't reach a legal guardian. The patient's not able to consent themselves. That's implied consent.
Yeah, no, and actually that brings up a really good question. This is a good scenario because I guess we're supposed to function based on our protocols, based on our standard operating procedures. And I think that's the hardest part I have about this scenario. Don't get me wrong. There's a moral and ethical part of me that doesn't like my answer. I don't like my answer. I don't like the fact that if my religion was, I don't want them giving IV fluids without consent because I don't want venipuncture, for whatever reason. As a parent and my child had it done, I would be really upset. And as a provider, I could see that and be like, as a moral and ethical guy. So I think this scenario has the three facets of moral, ethical, and legal, which if you're in EMT, you know, education land, they just group them all together. They just say medical, legal, ethical, when really it's like, it's kind of separated out. So I'm doing the legal right thing, but I don't know if I'm doing the ethically the best thing for this patient.
Right. Right.
So do you take the time on that, Jason, to say, hey, I'm going to try to reach out to the parents first?
Absolutely.
Depending on the severity and obviously what you've got in front of you.
Right. And frankly, at the end of the day, if I have time to sit around on a cell phone and wait to get a hold of dear Aunt Sally or whoever, the treatment's probably not that important, right? If the patient is critical and there's question about it, it's just going to get done, like Eric said, and we'll deal with it later. I would much rather have to answer for something I did in the best interest of the patient than answer for listening to a 15-year-old who could have been totally telling me something totally off the wall, not in conjunction with their legal guardian at all, and then have to answer for possibly for patient neglect that's much higher up than a protocol violation. A protocol violation is one thing. I can deal with that. A charge of patient neglect, that's something I'd have a significantly harder time with.
It's almost like you're doing risk stratification from what it sounds like. You're trying
absolutely. It's for anybody out in the interwebs that's ever listened to a guy named Gordon Graham, the owner of Lexapol, he does a phenomenal talk on high risk, low frequency. This is a high risk, low frequency situation. And those are the ones that could get you in the most trouble, right? Anybody that's out there, YouTube, Gordon Graham, high risk, low frequency, it's 15 minutes well spent.
Absolutely.
I use it in talks all the time because I can't explain high risk, low frequency better than Gordy Graham can. It's just not possible. It's exactly that. Do I have an answer that's going to fix every single solution, every single scenario like this? Absolutely not. Where I'm at, we have a pretty dense Mennonite and Amish population. And an example that I like to use as a teaching point a lot with them is they don't do anything on credit. So if we happen to fly one of their people out, the entire, what's depending on their sect, church or community, is responsible for the debt of any single one person in that community. So air medical transport becomes a big deal with this community. And like to the point where they have consented to have a pediatric patient whose head was run over by a steel tractor tire to a local community hospital versus, and the kid was still alive, versus being flown to a level one trauma center that was probably a 10-minute flight versus, 50-minute ground transport. They wouldn't even consent to the 50-minute ground transport. They will go to the local hospital, and it is God's will. And it's not even the parents making that decision. It's the church or community elder, but that's their hierarchy. And we've actually went so far as to have them come in to our EMS classes and our con ed classes and explain this. You could get that with multiple other sects of religious beliefs, of personal beliefs. You've kind of got to follow it, right? But if they're under the age of 18, if they're under the age of legal consent, that's a problem. So we fall back to this implied consent thing.
So it'd be interesting as well, because this also may kind of develop our transport as well. So as you were kind of mentioning, depending on the environment, but going back to our 15-year-old decision-making, this is maybe where we decide, again, based on stability, to stop at that local hospital to get sized up for what they need or to get the consent versus going on to a more distant transport as well.
Right.
So
I have had situations similar to that where, I'm lucky enough to be in the middle of two very, very well known level one trauma centers that are also teaching hospitals, University of Rochester and Upstate Medical University, literally right between them. And I've actually had situations, locally where the kid's like, oh, my parent works in Rochester, my parent works in Syracuse. And when we're trying to reach them for consent, I make the decision to head to one of those hospitals instead versus going local. I actually, if I can come up with a reason that's good enough to take them to one of those centers and I can get them closer to their parent, perfect. So another thing to kind of take into consideration if you're, in this particular scenario.
Well, and one of the things I want to kind of come back to is something you said just a minute ago. We could come up with, just the four of us could probably come up with 100 different scenarios right here. The idea here is to not answer all those scenarios for you, but just kind of give you the thought process behind as we see. Now, as you mentioned, as we start into some of this, as I get into that documentation, what I'm thinking, taking on very similar thought processes, Eric, is, I've made the decision that I am going to do this treatment because I know it is what is right. We've kind of decided that implied consent is the area that we're going with because this individual is underage and not sure if they're making the right decision. But it is one of those things that we should document that the patient did object. However, we made the decision to do this because of implied consent. Based on the time, I was not able to get to a individual of legal authority, and I did this on the best interest of the patient.
Correct.
So what would that look like to you? If you said 100%, this is what needed to be, continuing on with our scenario, what does that look like for you?
On a PCR? Pretty much exactly what you just said, David. Patient presented with blah, 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 blah. Patient verbally refuses IV fluid based on religious beliefs. Unable to obtain contact with a legal guardian after multiple attempts via whatever method. These days, cell phone, right? We're not going to try them on a ham radio or something. you know, multiple attempts to reach a parent or legal guardian by cell phone, and I'll actually document the numbers that I was provided with. Because, you know, how did little Johnny give you the right cell phone number? Yeah, these are the three, right? That just covers your backside just a little bit more. You know, was unable to contact a legal guardian based on the patient's condition. It's the opinion of this writer that is a clinical for this, the best clinical course that the patient receives XYZ treatment. XYZ treatment is provided to the patient based off of implied consent, and continue on with your PCR from there. You know that I'm based on the patient's condition and implied consent, I opted to treat the patient with this treatment modality.
And then, of course, right after that, you have your subsequent reassessment. The patient was positive, negative, or stayed the same.
Absolutely, and probably later in that chart, you're going to see another documentation of another attempt to contact. You know, especially if we get the patient stabilized, another attempt to contact legal guardians.
Now, one of the things I have done in the past as well is because I knew that the patient's complexity was bad enough that I didn't have enough time. So I passed that information off to dispatch and said, hey, I need you to contact in relay. And we could do that as well. And we just document that as well, provided these numbers to dispatch, attempted to gain contact and it didn't occur. So
sure, and the documentation of those attempts then falls back onto that dispatch center, right? They should have recordings of the radio request, recordings of the phone. As long as you're documenting that you contacted whatever dispatch center, the commercial service that I worked for covered four counties. Now I work for a county service, so it's pretty easy. We have one dispatch center to worry about. But you know, as long as you document what dispatch center you reached out to and the time, if there needs to be further proof of that done, then, you know, it can go through that particular dispatch center. All right, so it comes back as burden of proof, right? To protect yourself, it comes back looking for that burden of proof, which you have to provide at that point.
So before we get into the realm of no patient contacts and kind of keeping those separate, as we discussed earlier, what are your kind of, if you had a top five, top three, whatever it is, what are the top things that are commonly missed when an individual is writing a patient refusal, either of a skill or a treatment or of a transport in general?
If we stick with the concept of patient refusals here, I'd say the first thing that we are horrible at documenting industry-wide is the patient's understanding of the risks of refusing treatment and or transport. Did we explain those risks to them? Did they understand them? Risks of refusal were explained to the patient. Cool. We don't document anywhere in there, for the most part, as an industry, that they understood that. We don't document that they understood the risks of refusal. We just document that we explained them to them. Woohoo! We said something to a brick wall. That's awesome. It didn't answer us. It didn't tell us that it understood.
So, and those also have to be reasonable as well. So sure. The reason why I say that is I have heard, going back from my days of being precepted to watching other providers in the field, one of the things I commonly heard is the risks associated with this could be up to and including death.
Right.
And we all know that, you know, of the probability, okay, yes, if everything absolutely goes wrong, you may die the next 2 hours. Chances are, if we're having this conversation, it's not there. But one of those scare tactics, because so many people are concerned with, well, if I don't transport this patient to the hospital, we don't get paid, so I need them to go. So, hey, your stub toe that may be a broken foot may lead to death if you don't go to the hospital now. So we need to be accurate with what those are. Like, look, there are some risks. Here's the things you need to look at. Call us back if it doesn't word.
Absolutely. Listen, you know, if you don't go to the hospital, this could be broken. And if it needs to be set and you don't get it set, it could cause some more permanent issues or things that need to get corrected later. You know, but if you still want to refuse, that's okay. If it gets worse, like you said, give us a call back later. You know, you could have this up to and including seizure, coma, death. I see that on charts all the time. And no, you're not going to have seizure, coma, death from this. It is 99% probability that will not happen. You know, if you stubbed your toe and whacked your head and are on blood thinners and you didn't tell us, maybe, but probably not.
Kind of sounds like the side effects of every medication that is on TV these days.
Right.
This could lead to you having a bad cough and, oh, you may die after bleeding. Okay, we're about to get sued.
That disease comes with a hot chicken, a puppy. Can I have that? You know, no.
Yeah.
Okay, there it goes. We're off the rails now.
So that'd be the first thing. The second thing, real quick, I've got three of them. The second thing would be decision-making capacity. Patients A, no times four. What the heck does that mean? You're on the stand in 5 years. Mr. Hague, you document in your chart here that the patient's A&O times four. Can you define that for the court? What questions did you ask Mr. Smith to determine that he was alert and oriented times four? Oh, well, I don't remember what questions I asked him. Well, you can't remember what questions you asked him. How then can you tell us without hesitancy that the patient was in fact alert and oriented times four? Oh, you can't. Oh. Okay. You know, so decisional making capacity is the second one. And then the third thing, and this sounds really cliche, but it is so important in this scenario of refusals. If you didn't write it down, and I'm not talking about treatment, if you didn't write down conversations that were had, then they did not happen. And we are horrible with that. And I think speaking of conversations that Bradley wants to jump in with something here real quick, but, documenting specific conversations is super important.
Oh yeah,
cases.
And we've actually had that conversation. We'll tie over to Bradley there. That now with some of the new technologies, some of them are coming with the fact that you can actually tie verbal recordings into things. And so if you do utilize that, but make sure you get both sides of that basically.
And consent if you're going to record. Back to consent again.
All right, Bradley.
Well, I mean, I don't want to jump in. I think Jason's got one more, and then I might be able to jump in. I don't want to interrupt his flow.
Oh, no. Those are my three.
Okay. I thought you had one more. So
he fell asleep during one of them. It's all right. He's back now.
Yeah. Sorry. I'm back. one of the big things is, you know, when you talk to patients, you know, there's a huge difference between a patient-initiated refusal and a provider-initiated refusal. And how you talk to patients, what you document might be one thing, but how you talk on scene is another big issue we really need to talk about. There's a big difference between, do you want us to take you to the hospital versus you don't want us to take you to the hospital, do you? So when you start with that negative thing, you know, patients are most of the time going to refuse. So if you initiate the refusal in that manner, there's a lot of liability with that. So we need to be really careful in how we talk to them.
It's like asking a leading question in your patient assessment, right? You don't have any chest pain, do you? No, I didn't think you did. Or can you describe your pain for me? That's a nice, easy, open-ended question. Your chest pain, does that feel like a stabbing pain? Oh, yeah. You know, Bradley hit the nail on the head here. If you start with that connotation of offering transport, but not offering it per se, you know exactly how that's going to go, that provider-initiated refusal. You don't really need to go to the hospital for this, right? You just want us to check you out? Don't do that. The only time we, at least locally with us, the only time we were legally able to do that was sometime starting last March, and that expired in June, was the only time that we could do that. and we have never been able to do it before or after. You know, it was, unless you were dying, you didn't go to the hospital when we had our first COVID surge in New York State. And after that surge was over, it didn't even come back with the holiday surge at all. It was a one and done thing. And I didn't even need to initiate them half the time. You showed up in that first 2 months of COVID there, and they didn't want to go to the hospital anyway. But yeah, I think that was a once in a career time where you were allowed to have provider initiated refusals. Don't do that. Bad idea. Especially, you don't know how many people are sitting there when they call that have one of these. Yeah. And it may not be videoing, but it could certainly be recording. And I don't know about the rest of the country, but in New York State, only one person has to know the conversation's being recorded.
Oh, same in North Carolina. And the other part of that is we've got to be really careful with how we talk to them and everything else. And I think there is a purpose and a time for moving patients to alternate destinations. That's a whole different podcast that we can look at later. But we've got to be really careful with patient refusals and leading questions.
100%.
Very true. All right. No patient contact.
I don't think we have enough time, but we could definitely hit the tip of the iceberg here.
So what you don't put on something is DRT and circle it and submit it.
No, because I can't draw a really good circle with a mouse, so I just can't do that anyway.
That actually came in on one of our students' clinical documentation. This has been a while back, but it was in the EMT program, and his preceptor, he was asking his preceptor what he needed to write on his patient care report. So on the narrative, he wrote in DRT, circled it, signed it, and told him that's what he needed to submit.
Okay.
Is there anything wrong with that?
No. You know, it's equivalent to using ART, assuming room temperature. Yeah, you can't do that. If you lay eyes on the patient, for the most part, legally, you have made patient contact. And it's hard between one system and another. And I'm not only talking EMS systems, I'm talking documentation software systems as well. You show up to a car crash. This is a great scenario. A third party call to a car crash. You know, cell phone hero saw a car crash and called it in as they drove by, and they send the world, you know, they send the police department, fire department, EMS, and ALS. Everybody goes, unknown injury, traffic crash, because the cell phone hero couldn't bother to stop. They just saw a car banged up and they called 911 because they're helping. And we get there, and not a single one of the occupants of these vehicles wants anything to do with EMS at all. We've laid eyes on these patients to be able to find that out, right? So I'll pose the question of, do we need to get their name, address, telephone number, birthday, and all that, and have them sign a piece of paper? Or is it sufficient to write, arrived on scene of a two-car property damage motor vehicle collision. All occupants of the vehicles are over the age of 18 and refuse any contact with the EMS.
So I'll go ahead, since Eric popped in and answered this, the one I posed earlier, go ahead and answer this one for my thought. If they're willing to go through the process with you and engage, then I think you engage with them and you document what you find out. But if they don't, you document to the best of your ability, just like you said there, and move on. And, you know, because I do know that there's a, you know, a lot of conversation that we've had and really trying to get down into what authorities do we actually, what we actually have. And the thing is you can document your assessment of these patients based on what you see, what you hear, how you interact, and you may not end up with anything.
Right. It comes back to what we were discussing earlier, actually. Consent.
Right.
If that patient does not consent to us to evaluate them, patient refuses any contact with EMS, patient does not provide consent for an assessment, unable to obtain refusal signature, EMS returns to service.
Now, let me change that just slightly before we move too far ahead on this. And what happens is, so I'm just going to use my daughter right now. So she's 17 years old. She's getting ready to graduate high school. When it comes to everything, one of the things that we have had to deal with for the last couple of years is the fact that when, you know, she was a freshman in high school, people thought that she was a freshman in college. And so the problem is so she started driving last year, at this point, about 2 years ago, because her birthday is getting ready to come up. But with that being said, she's been out and about. What responsibility do we have? Because we use this on the other side as well to confirm that they are of age, because you made mention, you know, they're all peer above 18 years of age and deny consent. So what responsibility do we have in that?
At least in New York, we don't really have the ability to ask somebody to provide their ID to confirm their age.
Right.
We can't do that. I would say wait for our friends and colleagues in law enforcement to show up and get some driver's licenses or some IDs and confirm that everybody's 18 before we boogie on out of there.
So, that's the only real thing that I said there. They're going to have to get the reports. There's many different things we can play off there, because in Tennessee, if it's a small damage, then you can exchange information and move on. That's a whole different ballgame. We can chase the rabbit holes quite a bit, but, you know, utilize those. As you said, you know, the system sent everybody, you know, they're on the way, wait for them. They can gain some of that information. You can stay engaged, and you don't have to touch them at that point. Now, if they fall out, it's assumed they gave you their consent after that.
But yes, they've changed their mind.
So, kind of going like we did in the patient refusal, what are your common things that you usually see when it comes to the no patient contact documentation?
Laziness. Unless you can document why you were on scene for 10 or 15 minutes, and back to that scenario we just discussed, maybe we're waiting for law enforcement to show up so we could confirm the age of all the occupants. That better be documented in your chart that you were delayed on scene for that or any other reason. But I've never been able to find a good reason for a crew to be on scene for 5 or 10 minutes and their disposition is no patient contact or no patient found.
So in that instance,
you're either there and you have a patient, or you're there and you don't.
Right.
Not hard. Unfortunately, I've noticed with some providers, that's a very difficult concept of you either have a patient or you don't.
And that it may be that you're on scene for 5 minutes, but you're sitting there talking to law enforcement, talking to fire.
Right.
It's like, hey, was with them, looked about the scene, found nothing. Upon earliest exit, found our way out. But
right. I usually seem like that. I call in service on my portable the minute I'm done talking to the fire chief or the police officer. Man, no patient contacts can come back to bite you in a bad way later on.
And ultimately what you're saying, the laziness, instead of saying they refused treatment and this is how I assess to make sure they could, I'm just going to say I didn't touch them and I didn't make contact with them. And therefore
was 15 minutes before the end of my shift. I've got something going on in a couple of hours. I don't want to spend the time writing this chart, or God forbid, maybe taking this patient to the hospital. I pulled up on scene. Everybody looked okay. I asked some leading questions. Nobody wanted to go to the hospital. No patient contact. I'm back in service. Done. Seen it way too many times. But laziness, I think, is the number one issue with no patient found charts. I think another issue with no patient found charts is not fully documenting the circumstances around that. And we just kind of talked about a little bit with why there was no patient found, you know, arrived on scene waiting for verification of the patient's ages, or sorting out who was in what vehicle with law enforcement prior to clearing. The circumstances of it just need to be documented. Why was there not a patient found, or not no patient contact rather? You know, another one is, you know, you go for, maybe you're attached to the fire department for whatever kind of call you get dispatched to. Awaiting on scene for confirmation from the fire department that there are no patients, something like that. You know, but then what's your disposition? Is your disposition no patient or standby? Depends on your system.
I think that button is one that we can just say, I don't need to document anything else. I didn't touch them. We're good. And all right. Well, as we get to the end of our hour talking about documentation, this is the second hour of talking documentation with Jason. We're going to get his final thoughts now on patient refusals, no patient contacts, in a short 30-second elevator pitch. Tell people what they need to know about documentation and refusals.
Folks, document consent. Consent is huge. Document your type of consent that you obtained initially. If you're going to assess these folks, document your assessments and document that the patients understand the risks of refusing treatment or transport. If you don't have a patient, and you're documenting no patient found or no patient contact, make sure you really don't have a patient. For the ALS folks, if you get called with a BLS crew for an ALS link up and you see that patient, that's no longer a no patient found or a no patient contact. You got called as an expert with a higher level of care. And if you lay eyes on that patient and you're not canceled before you get there, you've got a patient and you were called as a higher level of care. So make sure you do your due diligence there. Now you can release that patient back to BLS or whatever, but please make sure that you're performing your job to the best of your ability, regardless of the circumstances. And it sounds cliche, but if you didn't document the circumstances, if you didn't document the reasons, and if you didn't document the consent and the patient's decisional making capacity, these things did not happen. And if you don't get a signature for the refusals, you have no physical proof of that patient's consent to that refusal either. So those are my final thoughts on refusals.
All right, we're going to go over to Eric for his final thoughts.
I think it'd be good to have a checklist for refusals. Just something that even if you put it on a note card, you write it down, put some scotch tape on it, whatever it is. Just get a checklist and have it ready to go. The other thing that does is, even if you have low bandwidth because like you've had a bad shift or you're inundated with a bunch of patient care documentation and you're in that area where you don't think you have to do much on documentation, at least going through the checklist will help you check the boxes and make sure you're going to stand at least legally and ethically clear of patient refusals and no patient contacts.
Just like an Army guy right there.
Yep, checklist.
Just
aviation.
Go, no go.
You got it.
You going to toss out their checklist too, Bradley?
Can I jump in on checklist real quick? if your agency doesn't have a refusal form with a checklist on it, come up with one, look like a hero, and take something off of your supervisor's plate. Boss, this is a checklist I came up with that we should put on our refusal form. Send it to the medical director. What do you think about it? All of a sudden you look like a rock star because you just came up with something awesome. So take that checklist from Eric and elevate it up a notch. I'm doing a talk at a conference later this week, and the topic is, I've been in EMS for years, now what? This is one of those now what situations. Come up with something, have an idea, make it happen. Be a creator, be a leader.
Hey, and before we go to Bradley for his final thoughts, that you just made a comment there. You've got an event coming up here soon, don't you, Jason?
I've got one. I'm speaking at one this week, the initial assessment conference in the Southern Adirondack region of New York State. And Bradley and I are actually going to be together in the Capital District in New York in October at the New York State Volunteer Ambulance and Rescue Association's Pulse Check Conference. And I think we may be coming to you live from there. I'm not sure, but more to follow on that, I think.
We'll give a little teaser out there, and we'll definitely promote that on this episode and all as well. But I guess the checklist next tells me I need to go to Bradley and hear about his checklist story as well. And he's muted. He forgot his checklist on how to unmute his microphone.
I got the checklist out.
No go.
No, I got it. So I didn't want you to hear me typing a minute ago. So, but yes, checklists are great. I actually sent one of the articles that I did a little while back over to Eric for him to either post a link to or whatever that appeared in one of our EMS trade journals. But case closed is my mnemonic and checklist, which we can talk about another time. But I use that as my checklist whenever I document refusals. So make sure that whenever you do that, you think about the five reasons for documentation as well, because it's the reason we document it's clinical, legal, operational, financial, and compliance. Biggest piece of this is being clinical and legal for refusals, because you may not get any financial reimbursement. So,
all right. Well, Jason, another great episode. We certainly appreciate you being there. Thank you, sir, for taking time out of your evening to record with us.
Oh, of course.
Always love having you. Well, you know, not too many times can you get by with talking about documentation for an hour, let alone going to a second hour and making it fun. But hopefully some people are finding good stuff from these and going to help them in their decision-making, whether they make a checklist or not. They're checking through their mind and seeing. So we're going to wrap up today by thanking each and every one of you and letting you know that without your feedback, we don't know exactly what you're thinking. So make sure to go to our platforms, subscribe, rate, and review. When it comes to our audio podcast, make sure to see Gems at EMS Today on Google, Apple, and Spotify. Subscribe, rate, and review to those as well. Excuse me, but don't forget about YouTube as well. We definitely want you to migrate over to our YouTube account as well. And let me just tell you guys, one of the things I love doing is watching these episodes. And right now, our two number ones, and they're almost going back and forth. And we're going to have to probably try to have both of them on in one episode. But Tyler Cristofoli and Jason Patton right there tied side by side. Jason, I'm sorry, you're down just a little bit right below those two guys. But make sure to go on YouTube, watch all of our episodes, including the third one that we released here previously with Jason. YouTube is great. Make sure to hit subscribe and see those episodes as well. So on behalf of my co-host, Eric McCullough and Bradley Dean, this is David. Take care, stay safe, and always remember the value of your EMS handoff.